Hey, it's therapist and relationship coach Micah Ross, and this is the How to Talk About It podcast. It did not surprise me when in 2015, an article was released in the Journal of Family Issues, citing perceived fairness of distribution of household and family-related tasks to be the number two predictor of a woman's marital satisfaction, only to be topped by faithfulness. In my practice as a couples therapist, this just felt true. The sentence that I often hear women booming in frustration at their spouses in my office is, "Why do I have to tell you what to do? Why can't you just know?" The sentiment among women, in heterosexual relationships at least, generally seems to be that they want a partner, a co-pilot. They don't want to feel alone in the household or parenting departments. They don't want to manage and monitor their spouses or to be the seer of all the things. This all seems to be about more than not wanting dishpan hands. It seems to be about wanting to be respected, wanting to feel like a priority, and craving to feel deeply seen, heard, and understood. The super perplexing thing to me used to be that their partners, from what I could tell, were not what I would call deadbeat dads. They were often happy to help, happy to change diapers, happy to get up in the middle of the night, and were proud to be involved in their kids' lives. "Just tell me what to do and I'll do it. I'm not a mind reader," men often say in my office. But this way of operating often led to what I call the caricature of marriage, the nagging, bitchy wife, and the nincompoop, incompetent husband. With women in the driver's seat in the household and family-related tasks department, they're often in a managing and monitoring role. "That thing that I asked you to do, did you do it yet? How about now? Is it done now?" Which, of course, gets met with defensiveness. Everyone ends up feeling disrespected and like they can't do it right or enough. Years ago, I personally had a therapist tell me, "Men just aren't good at this stuff." But then how is this woman's husband a project manager of multi-million dollar projects at work, but she can't trust him to follow through on what seem like relatively small tasks at home? I just didn't buy it. Over many years leading couples out of the sticky situation that is figuring out how to distribute household and family-related tasks without hating each other, I've come to realize that there's so much that's invisible that gets in our way and is setting marriages and families up to fail. Today, I've enlisted the help of a motherhood sociologist, didn't even know those existed, Dr. Caitlin Collins, to help me make visible one of the most insidious hurdles that I see, the wildly different cultural expectations that we have of moms versus dads.
Okay, so Caitlin, you are a motherhood sociologist and researcher. And to be really honest, I knew I wanted to do this topic. It's something that I talk about quite a bit here, there, and everywhere. And I knew I wanted an expert on this, but I didn't quite know what kind. And I typed in motherhood sociologists, and you were the first. I didn't even know if it was a thing that existed. And you were the first person to pop up. You're in my town of St. Louis here at Washington University, and your background and expertise seems very extensive. And I was like, I need her. And you were very agreeable. And so we're here today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Yeah. So as a relationship counselor over the last 18 years, how to deal with distribution of household and family related tasks, how to deal with the differences in expectations of moms and dads, and then how those moms and dads live together and don't despise each other. Those are all things I was not explicitly trained in. And it seems to be something that I'm working with and within every single day. But from my perspective, there just seems to be so much invisible stuff that's working against us and feels like setting us up to fail in marriage and family. So I wanted to have you on to lift the veil on a lot of that for us. So I want to talk about so many things, but can you tell us a little bit about your research in this area?
Sure. Yeah. I think maybe I can give you a bit of background about how I became interested in studying motherhood as a sociologist. I grew up with a very ambitious and successful working mother myself. I had a mom who worked in corporate sales and marketing. She loved her job. I have a little sister, so she was raising two daughters. And she and my dad got divorced when I was 8. And then she continued her high-flying career while being primarily responsible for raising my sister and me. And she did it, but she did it with a lot of stress and a lot of overwhelm. And as the listeners of your podcast, I'm sure can relate to, very often there's a snow day with school or a babysitter falls ill and the house of cards crumbles. And my mom was left often trying to pick up those cards and make it work another day. And she hit a breaking point a few years after getting divorced and decided that she just could not try to do both these jobs at once, be the kind of mother she wanted to be and the very successful career woman that she wanted. And so she quit her very successful job and she took on a part-time job doing the same work, but consulting that had no benefits, right? No health insurance, things like that, paid her way less, but she was effectively a stay-at-home mom when my sister and I weren't in school. And she would tell you this is the best decision she ever made. But I remember thinking growing up that something didn't seem fair about this, that all of this fell to my mom and that she had to give up this other whole part of herself that she really adored, that she found a great deal of meaning and fulfillment in. And as I grew up, I became a teenager and a young woman myself and an adult, I remember thinking like, it can't possibly be this way for everybody, right? It's got to look different in other places. And I lived abroad after graduating from undergrad and saw myself how gender and work and family look very different in other countries that have really different cultural ideas about these topics and also really different policies to support parents in blending their paid employment and their caregiving. And that spurred my interest in conducting research on this myself as a sociologist. As a bit of background, I wrote a book, as you mentioned, called Making Motherhood Work. This was an interview project I conducted over 5 years with middle-class working moms in Sweden, in Germany, in Italy, in the United States to figure out how they go about managing careers and caregiving. And again, in these places that have very different beliefs about what men and women can and should do when it comes to work and family. And again, like I said, different policy supports. So that's the background in my interest and also the foundation of the book.
So it sounds like you were witnessing what was happening with your mom, with your parents.
Yeah.
And seeing something that didn't feel quite right.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you didn't let that go.
No. And my mom always joked that I was the fairness police as a child. She was like, you're the fairness monitor at home. You're always like, my sister's dessert is bigger than the piece of dessert that I got, whatever. And now the joke is that my job is actually to be a fairness monitor of our entire society, to be like, wait a second, men and women, this is not playing out equitably, right? So my mom likes to joke my career is now to be a professional fairness monitor. And here I am talking with you about that today.
Oh my gosh. So I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And I think for women who grew up after the 1970s, in the 1970s, women, I can't remember what the Credit Card Act was, but before mid-1970s, women couldn't have credit cards, women couldn't purchase a house on their own. And that seemed like such a thing of the past growing up. And I felt as a kid, girls can do anything, boys can do better. My mom worked. My grandma had her own business. I grew up going to my mom's softball games. I was playing sports. Until parenthood, I didn't feel very different than my male counterpart.
Or disadvantaged.
Or disadvantaged. Or what in the F is going on here?
Yeah, sure.
So your research with other cultures is really fascinating to me. I love going to other countries because I feel like it does put on its head everything that we think is the way that it has to be or is just the way that it is.
Yep.
So tell me about the differences culturally that you noticed with moms and dads.
Sure. I think the easiest comparison to draw is to Sweden among the countries that I did because it's just so different from the US. So Sweden as a country is very interesting. It is a country that is often held up as being the most gender equal society in the world. It is a nation that has combined its gender equality policy with its family policy and labor policy for decades now. And so that means that the goal of combining employment and child rearing is expected to be one held equally by men and women. There is a cultural expectation of equality in the worlds of work and family.
What does that look like?
In day-to-day life. Yeah. So the joke amongst Swedes is that Americans get off the airplane and look around at all of the men who are out in public in parks, on the metro, at the grocery store, schlepping around kids on errands. And Americans look really confused at these Swedes and ask Swedes, why do so many men work as nannies here? And that is Swede's way of calling out this assumption that surely if men are caring for children alone in public, they must be getting paid for it. It has never even occurred to Americans that those might actually be their parents, right?
Uh-huh.
And I have to admit that as an American living in Sweden, conducting this research in Stockholm, I was also absolutely struck at all these men alone in public without women. And I'm seeing more of this now than I did a decade ago when I conducted these interviews, which is really encouraging to me. But a decade ago, it was very unusual in the U.S. to see this happening. And if you did see a dad in the grocery store with his kids, like strangers were coming up and patting him on the back, telling him what a great job he was doing, how lucky their kid was to have them as a role model. No one has ever walked up to a U.S. mom and said that your kiddo is really lucky to have you as a role model grocery shopping right now, right? Never.
No, no. And this is an example that I talk about. I've made silly reels about, but it's from real examples.
Yes.
My husband would go out into the world, take our kids to the park or a kid to the park or strap a baby to him in a carrier like I did every day.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just get oohed and awed over and told he was doing such an amazing job. And I would go out into the world and my kids would be doing the same things that they were doing with him, you know, likely throwing tantrums and being developmentally appropriately toddlers.
Yes.
And I wasn't getting the accolades that he was. And it almost felt like he would go out into the world and everyone would tell him he was more than enough.
Yes.
And I was constantly getting messages that I wasn't enough. I can't keep up.
Yes.
I'm not measuring up. There's all this Pinterest stuff that isn't my thing.
Yes.
My kids' birthday parties don't look like that.
Yep.
All of these standards and expectations that aren't getting shoved in his, he's like on a pedestal.
You're right. And this makes complete sense when you mentioned that you didn't really feel these gendered norms in the same way after you had kids that you did before you had kids. And that makes a lot of sense to me because research shows time and again that moments of big transition in our identities are when we feel these kind of big influences of these external structures on our lives, like when we get married, when we graduate college, right? When we start a new job, and certainly parenthood is one of them. And so if we're thinking about what looks different in these other countries, the idea that parenthood is meant to be equal between men and women is fascinating to me. And so you see how these laws in a Swedish context are actually reflected in and reinforced by everyday life for Swedish society. So, you know, written into Sweden's welfare law is that a child has a right to equal access to both their parents. And so talking to men in Sweden, I would say, gosh, it's so cool here as an American in Sweden to see so many men equally involved in child rearing and think that they really have this kind of equal duty or obligation to be involved in raising their kids. And these Swedish men would look at me funny and a little confused and be like, obligation? Duty? No, no, I have a right to spend time with my child. I have a right. And that was revolutionary as an American to hear anyone, but a dad in particular, say, actually, I have a right to time with my kid just like my partner does if they were heterosexual, right? If my wife spends time with my kids, why don't I also have a right to spend that just as much time with my child? So switching this discourse, instead of I'm so lucky to being, I'm enacting a right of mine, I am entitled to time with my child, to me felt like a really important cultural shift that is reinforced by Swedish law about how women and men can participate in paid work and family life that I just loved. And I really want to bring that discourse to the U.S. context.
Yeah. So sometimes it's been years since I was in academia, either getting degrees or teaching. So sometimes I cite research and I'm like, how old is this thing that I'm saying?
That's all
so
good.
Take it all with a grain of salt. But I remember teaching human growth and development.
Mm-hmm.
And there was research at that time, 2006, 2007, saying that the involvement of dads is as important as the involvement of moms. And when my parents got divorced, at the time, it was really customary for dads to get their kids every other weekend and on Wednesdays.
Mine
and,
was Monday that, nights, and every other
week. And I think that communicates that dads maybe aren't as support as, my dad's not here to ask, but I do wonder about how he valued or thought about his role. And I do think he undervalued it.
Yeah.
I don't think it meant that he didn't love and care about me deeply, but I do wonder if he undervalued
himself,
his role.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the truth is, honestly, so first of all, by comparison to Sweden, in Sweden, the default is an equal division of custody when parents split up, which is very different from the U.S. context because, again, our gendered cultural beliefs underlie our laws, including our divorce law and child custody laws, right? So you change your gendered cultural norms, you also change your laws, and they mutually reinforce one another, right? So if you think fathers and mothers both deserve equal access to time with their children, then of course it follows that if that couple is no longer cohabiting, that the children should spend time with both of them. And I'm thinking about what you said about your dad. Here in the United States, historically speaking, our understanding of what it meant to be a quote-unquote good father, it meant breadwinning. It meant financially providing for your children. So if you bring home the bacon, you're a good dad. So I think that has meant that a lot of parents, a lot of men in particular, don't think about time spent with their children as part of their of what it means to be a good parent. And of course, women have thought that for a long time, that especially with these kind of intensive mothering ideals today, that what it means to be a good mom is to devote all your time, all your energy, all your resources to your children's well-being, growth, and development, and to subsume your own needs under theirs, to put them before yourself, just is not how men think about these things in the U.S. So it's easy to think, oh, we're past all of this. We're living in a post-gender era. Men want to be involved in family life, so we've solved all this. We absolutely haven't solved all this. That's the truth. And we're pushing against, again, these deeply ingrained beliefs about what constitutes a good mom and a good dad. And the truth is, despite anyone's individual personal experience, that culturally speaking, at a societal level, we hold very different beliefs of what it means to be a good father than what it means to be a good mother in the U.S. today.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the really tricky things that's invisible, that's getting in our way. I have degrees in marriage and family counseling. I did not quite finish my PhD, but I went to school for a very long time, studied all of this. And despite that fact, I was pregnant with my first child in my PhD program. And my husband and I's, our biggest fight while I was pregnant was about something, of course, totally unrelated. But because I had the skills to get under the surface, what he was really afraid of, I had decorated something or bought something from Target, a decorative thing. And he was like, so you're just not going to ask me? You're just going to decorate the house? Mm. And I was like, if you don't like the thing from Target, I'll just return it. But you weren't at Target ask. So I just picked it. When we could calm down and I said, what's going on? Like, what are you afraid of? And it really got deep. And he was like, I'm afraid you're going to have all the say, that I'm not going to get to be the kind of involved dad that I want to be. So I have degrees in marriage and family counseling. I have big aspirations for my career. I'm in a PhD program. I looked at him and I said, no, I need you to be that.
Yeah.
I don't want all the say. I don't want that to be I want you to be involved. Despite all of that, we still slid into what feels like this track that's very slippery here and invisible, and found ourselves in the same place that most other heterosexual couples do, where a year in, I'm yelling at the top of my lungs, like, why do I have to tell you what to do? Why can't you just know?
Yes. Oh, this resonates. Yep. Even though you could have all the degrees in the world, you're fighting against a very deeply ingrained set of beliefs, of roles, of norms, of expectations that you've been socialized into, both of you, since the day that you were born, and arguably before so, because we gender fetuses, right? With the sorts of clothes we buy for them and the words we use to describe them the moment they are born, right? So from the second you take your first breath on this planet, you are taught gendered ways of being in the world. And that means gendered ways of being in your family. And certainly we do that as kids. But then those kids grow up and become adults with these beliefs ingrained in them, that even when we get a whole bunch of education that tells us that these are social constructs and that they can look different, we're fighting against a whole lifetime of socialization. So I'm right there with you. And there's a lot of research that shows that even the most egalitarian intending couples, when they have children, fall into traditional gender patterns. And so you are not alone in that pattern, but it also doesn't mean it has to be this way.
Agreed. Yeah. It took me a while to realize that being cognitively egalitarian and behaviorally egalitarian were two very different things. And that my husband said recently, I think I may have told you this, I tried to do a podcast episode with him It didn't go well, talking about how we have figured out what equity looks like in our household and family. And it's been an ongoing, never-ending process. And what I realized is that I have been spearheading that process, which I think, you know, being the person who's expected to be in the role of overfunctioning, with in family systems theory, there's this term called overfunctioning, underfunctioning reciprocity. So if you think about enabling and an addict, everybody's pretty familiar with that, that there's enabler is likely overfunctioning, which is allowing that addict to underfunction. So the person in that system who holds the power to create the most change is the overfunctioner refusing to overfunction, which allows the underfunctioner to rise to the occasion. And I realized in trying to talk to him about this that he was really unaware of what had happened in our household for him to rise to the occasion. And he had the assumption just a couple of months ago that everybody functions like us, that everyone has what they would consider a 50-50 split or something that's fair. Sometimes 40-60 is fair, sometimes 70-30 is fair, depending on what you have going on in your life.
Sure.
But he said, yeah, only dicks don't do their fair share. I was like, oh my gosh, we have to turn off this podcast because, and my daughter, she's 16. She was like, do you follow mom on Instagram? But it's so invisible.
Yeah.
Even, and I think that's what's it. Sometimes I'll do little funny videos on Instagram depicting the disparity in household and family related tasks or with parenting between men and women, just to put a funny spotlight on it in a really lighthearted way. And then I give ways to deal with it in the caption that I don't think anybody reads. But
I'm sure that your daughter sounds like she's reading them.
Well, she is. And a lot of commenters will say things, they'll use the term weaponized incompetent.
Yeah.
And I think for the large majority of men in my practice, there is nothing intentional or weaponized about their incompetence. And I wouldn't even call it incompetent. It's like there is a, this is going to sound, I don't like saying it this way. And I, if there's another way to say it, I need it. But it's, I feel like women have been trained into what to see. Men have been trained into what to see. And they've been trained to see provide, where I feel like women, we've been trained to go into the workforce as well. But then their training hasn't shifted to any of the household and parenting.
Yeah.
Like, we got to dust the baseboards before people come over. My husband's like, why? And
why?
I'm like,
what's a
I get judged if that doesn't happen and you don't.
Yeah.
So...
you're right.
Either I have to give up that needing people to not judge me, or
I hear
we need to clean
you
the
deeply.
Baseboard.
And the truth is, when we zoom out to look historically about why it might be that you pay attention to the dust on the baseboards and your husband doesn't, we have to think, as you just said, about the expectations we hold people to. And historically speaking, at least in most like white middle class families, it was men's job to work outside of the home, and lots of women were homemakers. And so there was a pretty even divide in the labor there. Everybody was working. It just that was one was outside the house and one was in the house, right? But they were both important to the family system. In the mid-20th century, we had dramatic changes post-World War II where women entered the paid labor force in unprecedented numbers, which was, of course, in many ways a good thing. It meant increasing economic independence for women, right? More greater sense of identity and fulfillment outside the home, right? It gave them all sorts of autonomy they didn't have before. But what we didn't get was a similar revolutionary change on the part of men taking on that work of the home. So we now have women today in 2024 participating nearly on par with men in the paid labor force. Most adults and most parents work outside the home for pay, and most of them do so full time. However, 2/3 of housework and childcare continue to be completed by women in the home. So what we are missing is substantial behavioral change on the part of men, like you said. And so, as you said, if someone like your husband has been taught that provide is what it means to be a good father, but also just a good man in the world, a good person who's gendered as a man, that's very different than you as a woman who have been gendered to understand that keeping a dust-free home is part of what it means to be a good mother and a good woman. But it's sociologists talk about this as the second shift, right? This is a term Arlie Hochschild coined a couple decades ago to talk about the immense amount of labor that's done after your regular paid workday at home to keep the place afloat. And we call that work like the work of social reproduction, like the thankless menial tasks that go into your family functioning, sorting the laundry, putting it in the washer, moving it to the dryer, bringing it up, folding it, and putting back into the drawers is a lot of work. And someone has to do it. Some folks outsource it, right? That's one way they've managed the inequity in their household labor in heterosexual families. Or, of course, same-sex couples can do this too. But often it's because one person is pissed that they're doing more of it. And so if they can afford it, they outsource it. But the truth is, so much of this household labor still falls to women. And it does create resentment, as you said. It holds them back in the paid labor force. And we do need men, as you said, to do more of this work. And I don't necessarily see much of it as weaponized incompetence, like you said. Like, my own partner would never think about the baseboards before someone comes over. And it's not that he's thinking about them and being like, ha, there's dust on them, but it's not my job. Surely you'll pick it up. It's that it would never occur to him that having guests to the house has anything to do with our baseboards. And I actually think it probably shouldn't for me either.
Same.
So changing our expectations of ourselves, but also like of the way we evaluate others when we go to their homes matters too. Mm-hmm. So I think we live in a world today where having two full-time jobs and raising children it's too much work to maintain a household and do all of that at once. So some stuff has to give. And I'm in my own life trying to figure out what that means, like what needs to give, because my sanity cannot give. My sleep cannot give. What is often giving right now is like my leisure time, my friendships, my time exercising. Like, those things really matter. And I need to find other things like my baseboards maybe that need to go fall by the wayside. And so figuring out what that looks like and how men can take on more of the stuff that actually really is important. Maybe it's not the baseboards, but it's grocery shopping or it's the laundry.
Yep.
And I think you have done a fabulous job facilitating countless conversations with couples about that. And it's not weaponized incompetence so much as just a lack of socialization into what really needs to be done to keep a household afloat.
Yes. And I agree. Despite doing this work day in and day out, this Thanksgiving, I had a list of things to do, which I ended up prioritizing with the Eisenhower priority matrix. Nobody knows what that is. You need to Google it. And I really do have to still consciously be aware of, like, why do I think this needs to be done?
Yeah.
And is it about me wanting to avoid perceived future judgment? Mm-hmm. And or does it really matter to me and my family and whatever people having a good time at my house on Thanksgiving? And I think the degree to which we're not conscious of that and aware and really analyzing that is the degree to which we are part of the problem.
Yeah.
Like, the degree to which we're buying into these outrageous expectations.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Is the degree to which we're part of the problem. And so my husband and I will often prioritize together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really fascinating exercise because he can easily just, not a priority.
Yep.
Not a priority.
Baseboards
and just
out.
just throw things off the list. And we get through the list and I'm like, God, how refreshing. That not even to make it on a thing that you're considering doing. That must be so lovely. I hope I get there one day.
Yes. Could I just have traded socialization with you and have a new brain implanted in my head that would mean that I don't worry about the stuff that I do? I just made a giant list for our household of like my summer goals for getting our house whipped into shape. And it's so ambitious and silly. And I know that a lot of the things on the list I just need to set by to the side. And the best way for me to do that is probably to talk to my partner about it, because it will be very simple for him to be like, nope. Whereas for me, they matter. And then the point you just made is such a good one, that it's really hard to disentangle what actually matters to me versus what I've been socialized to care about, because we cannot step outside of our socialization. We cannot step outside of our society and be like, society tells me this, but I feel this way. There is no, I feel this way without society, right? You cannot step outside of it and look back at it as if you are separate and distinct. And that's messy, right? It's that analogy of fish in the water, right? Is not seeing what you can't actually name. And so that to me is what so much of this domestic labor is about, is like calling it out and really trying to crystallize our own expectations that are both hidden and conscious for ourselves and our partners to bring about more equity. And I think of equity, really importantly, as a project more than a goal, because it sounds like it's an end line, right? Like, if you just run that football all the way to the end of the field, you're going to have made it. The truth is that, of course, it's a lifelong project, and realizing that that it's a project that changes and shifts is, to me, a better way to think about it than a goal line, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. Always changing and shifting.
Exactly.
And these kids are always changing and shifting. And so then their needs are always changing and shifting. And then so you have to change. It's just, never ending.
Yeah.
You said that it's like that fish in the water.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that people, which we heard a lot about Sweden. Mm-hmm. What are working moms in other countries maybe doing different than working moms
here
in the U.S.?
One huge answer to that question has to do with their perspective. And the perspective that I heard from moms in Italy and Germany and Sweden that felt so remarkably different from moms here is that they do not blame themselves for their stress and exhaustion and overwhelm and guilt as working moms. And
what?
I know American moms are like, but who else would you blame? And the answer is lots of other sources that have nothing to do with themselves. So in Sweden and Germany, moms talked to me a lot about these intensive mothering ideals. They were like, the expectations are too high. And that is unreasonable to ask that of myself. So when I start feeling guilty, I stop and think, wait a second, it's unreasonable to suggest that I bring home-baked bread to the kindergarten every Friday, right? I don't have time for that. That's not me. That's society, right? So they can externalize the source of blame in a really important way. And Italians did that with men and their employers and the government and said, no wonder I'm stressed, right? I don't have the sort of public childcare support that I should have. Look at my counterparts in a country close by, right? They have high quality, affordable care for children, for example, starting at the age of one. We don't have it till three here. I'm pissed that I don't have more childcare support. Or I'm mad that my husband doesn't do more around the house, or that my employer doesn't offer me the flexible schedule that my friend in Norway has. And Americans don't expect help from anyone ever, especially women. They think that they should do it all themselves. And so when they don't, they blame themselves for not accomplishing what is Herculean and impossible.
So instead of feeling shame, there's something wrong with me.
Yes.
They are able to say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with what's happening here.
Yes.
And I heard you say that you wonder if them being able to notice that has to do with their proximity to other cultures and people, other people doing things differently.
Very much so. Yeah. I talk about this in the book that I think in the US, we have this idea that America is like the best place on earth, right? We're number one.
Yeah,
and this rugged individualism, we live in this meritocracy where we should pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, right? The truth is, of course, think about our news media. They rarely, until the pandemic, I would say, did a very good job of covering what was happening in other countries. So we don't have a lot of good cultural alternatives to envision for what our lives can look like. Whereas these folks in Europe, think about these countries as also being the size of our states, right? So if you want to take a weekend trip, instead of us being here in St. Louis and popping over to Kansas City or Nashville, you're popping over to a whole different country with a whole different language, history, cultural environment, etc. And so they are exposed to other places in closer geographic proximity. But I also think there's just more of a cross-cultural set of communications and understandings that play out that we don't have here. And so I think understanding, being able to externalize and say, gosh, the reason I'm so exhausted and overwhelmed isn't because I'm failing. It's because this system is not set up to support my thriving, my flourishing. And that is what I want to get across to Americans, is that like your stress and overwhelm is not your fault. And that also means it's not on you to resolve it. The system is failing you. So rather than shame and guilt, I want you to spend your time thinking about righteous anger. And women are really discouraged from feeling angry, but I think it's a really important emotion because it is generative. It creates motivation to rally for change. And that, as a sociologist, is a message I think is really important.
Quite often, I have women come into my practice and say things like, I yelled at my kids, I need help. This can't happen again. You have to teach me how to not do this. Mm-hmm. And there's something wrong with me. And I inevitably, with a long line of questioning, end up getting them to a place where I'm asking them, what could have happened 4 days ago? How could have the 4 days or 3 days prior to when you lost it on your family or your child, what did you need in those 3 days prior for that moment not to happen? And inevitably, it's, I needed a break.
Yeah.
Or I'd been on with the kids for 12 hours a day, and my husband was out of town. And I was just, and it's, okay, that sounds really reasonable. Also, I wouldn't expect a babysitter to have a Mary Poppins attitude on hour nine with my children.
That's an unreasonable expectation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so we expect things of ourselves as women and mothers, I feel like, that we would never, ever expect out of anyone else. When we had our third child, I deeply knew that I could not be the kind of mom, partner, friend that I wanted to be if the same systems were going to be in place when we had two kids. I knew that wasn't going to work when we had three. just the mornings would have looked like dropping three kids off at three different places. And by the time 9 o'clock hit, I would have been done for the day.
Ready to go take 4 hours. Yeah. Yep.
After crying, after peeing on the little piece pregnancy test, then having a really big freak out, what are we going to do? I asked myself a question that I ask clients a lot, which is, if I had $5 million in the bank, what would I do? Mm-hmm. And this question isn't about money. I know it sounds like it is. But I said I would have somebody live with us.
Yeah.
And I held on to that. I was talking to a friend's mom one day, and I said that to her. She was also a therapist, so it was a helpful conversation. She said, what about an au pair? And I was like, an au what? She said, an au pair. It's like a foreign exchange nanny that lives with you. Part of their pay is room and board, so they're less expensive than a nanny. And I was like, these things exist? But it totally changed my... One, she came with a set of rules from the government.
Yeah.
And I was reading over the rule, and it said she cannot work for more than 45 hours a week. She cannot work for more than 10 hours a day. Au pairs need to have at least, 48 hours off consecutively once a month, 18 hours every week. It was all these, and I was reading them like, yes, of course, yes, of course, yes, of course. I'm not a slave driver. They can only do the children's laundry. You can't have them grocery shopping and doing all the other things in your house. And I was like, yeah.
Obviously.
Except for the fact that I was expecting all of that and more out of myself.
With a full-time job.
Every day basis. I was working. I was seeing clients 3 days a week. I was teaching two nights a week. I was part-time childcare for the kids. I was grocery shopping and decorating and doing taxes while I was childcaring. But those expectations and guidelines that she came with really made me take a hard look at what I was expecting of myself.
Of course.
And thinking, it's not me.
No.
It's the system.
Two full-time breadwinning parents with children cannot do all of that. And so, of course, thinking about having essentially a third set of hands, a third adult set of hands, makes all the sense in the world to me. And until someone else points it out to you, sometimes it's really hard to see what's right there in front of you. And I'm so glad you found an extra source of support. We all deserve it. And I think there are ways we can create that for ourselves by asking more of our elected officials. And you need time off after you have a baby. We need healthy and safe daycare spaces for them to go to while we work, right? There are solutions to these problems. They're not intractable. And I think conversations like this are a good step in the right direction.
So then what does mom guilt look like in other countries?
So they do feel guilty, but they can assuage their guilt with the policies available to them, right? So moms in Sweden said, yeah, I think it's really important that I spend a lot of time with my kid. So because in Sweden, you have a legal right to reduce your working hours to a 75% schedule or 30 hours a week until your child is 8 years old, parents would tell me, yeah, so I pick up my kid every day at 3. That's how I address that need to spend more time with my child. Is that my partner and I alternate picking up our kiddo early, or your parental leave days. Parents in Sweden get 480 days of paid leave that can be used flexibly up until their children are 8. Lots of parents also save some of those parental leave days and take longer vacations with their family each summer, right? So they can use the sorts of policies available to say, time with my kid is really important. If I don't get it, I don't feel like a great parent. I will use these policies to help enact what I think of as good parenting. When you lack those here in the U.S., there are no sources of support that you can fall back on to help you, right? Lots of parents in the U.S. feel bad because they don't think their kid is in a very healthy or safe daycare. In a country where that's provided for you and highly subsidized, that's not a source of guilt for you because you know and can go to work every day confident in the knowledge your child is thriving, right? A lot of U.S. parents don't have that, I would say, luxury, but it's not a luxury. I think it should be a right.
I have had clients who in Sweden, from Sweden, and when I hear about their culture, there's just so much that's baked into their culture that encourages well-being. They have a word, fika, for
afternoon coffee.
Getting coffee with your friends. Yes. It's a verb. It's a noun.
You stop work every day to go have fika. This is like
really they
important.
Get a month of vacation every year. Yeah. Like there's so much baked in other countries, even with just socialization and third spaces, that I feel like we have to work so hard to create.
Yeah.
And we have to work so hard, the au pair, like think out of the box to figure out creative solutions. And it sounds like in other places, well-being for parents seems more baked in.
Well, and I think it's because it's well-being for everybody to a degree, right? Yeah. We care more about communal well-being than we do here because we have this really individualistic understanding of who should be responsible for one another. And I think the truth is that we should feel a sense of collective responsibility for our well-being and not it, my next door neighbor's problem is to take care of themselves all by themselves, right? It's like, actually, don't we owe it to one another in this short, beautiful life we have on the planet to make sure all of us have the time we need to care for ourselves and our family and to thrive in that way? And I think that they've figured that out in other ways. It's not perfect anywhere, but I think what's the alternative? Loneliness, isolation, burnout, illness, I think. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think we have to do the hard work of envisioning having someone like an au pair, right? Forming co-housing communities, getting therapists who provide us with the sort of support we need to
think outside the box.
Exactly. Yes. What is the alternative? It's not acceptable. So to me, this is the good hard work of moving forward.
It feels like the longer that people are in the mode of blaming themselves, the less time they're spending trying to figure out what could shift and change outside of themselves.
And when you're exhausted and tired, who's got time to sit around and think creatively about this stuff, right? That's why a friend had to bring you the au pair solution. But if you hadn't carved out time for that conversation, you'd have been in trouble. And I get it. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. The au pair that ended up living with us was from Spain. That was 11 years ago. We're still in contact with her. But she looked at me one day and she said, I don't think au pairs exist in Spain. I don't know how true that is. But she said she grew up in a situation. She lived in what we would consider like a row home. Mm-hmm. So she, her sister, her mom, and her dad lived here in one row home. And then the one directly next door was her aunt and uncle. Her aunt and uncle didn't have children. And grandma lived in the basement. And there was a way to get from one to the other in the basement. And just hearing that as a young mom with three kids, the relief that filled my body thinking about having kids with an aunt and uncle next door, grandma in the basement, and not doing it. I don't think parenting is a two-person job. I don't think running a household and family is a two-person job.
I agree.
Let alone a one-person job.
Yeah. Goodness. I really cannot fathom, but people do it day in and day out. And thinking about what it means to raise children in community and in this kind of village vibe that we talk about is so real. And I think we actually need to take that really seriously. What does it mean to try and create that for ourselves? Because many of us don't have it baked in to our families or into our neighborhoods. And so we have to find a way of doing this in less isolation because it's not sustainable. It's not healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. I love what led you to thinking about how other cultures do things.
I taught abroad in Spain. You just mentioned Spain for a year after undergrad. And then I lived in Germany for a while. And it just, I could see that being a working parent there looked so different.
Different.
Being a working mom looked so different that I was like, people are organizing this. Societies, governments are organizing life differently here. What is going on here? And why can't we do more of this in the U.S.? And I also, of course, uncovered that there's also all sorts of thorniness and nuance to those other societies that might from the outset be like, oh, Sweden's perfect. Everyone should just be like Sweden. It's actually complicated. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Also, that's not ideal. But thinking cross-culturally helps me open up my imagination to thinking again more creatively and expansively about what's possible. And so that's why I think that exposing ourselves to other worldviews is really essential to helping shape our own in a more critical, inclusive way.
Awesome. I love talking to you so much.
This was such a dad. Thank you. Thank you.
Any advice that you have for working moms?
Don't blame yourself. It's not you. It's the system. And expect more from men. Expect more from your employers. And expect more from your government. You deserve it.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of course. Yeah, this is a gift.
Hey, it's Micah. If you're not watching on YouTube, you didn't see my fists pumping as Caitlin told women, don't blame yourself. It's the system. It's not you. The expectations are too high. The hurdles too invisible. But there's so much we can do about it. And I believe a powerful way to start is just to see it. So, do you see it? Do you see how these wildly different expectations of moms and dads have infiltrated your brains and are likely impacting your relationships? What we see, what we don't see, what our priorities are, how we value our roles as parents, and even have influenced our ideas of what success is. The less we see them, I think the easier it is to blame and criticize our partners, blame and criticize ourselves, and the harder it is to communicate in a way that gets couples to resolutions and sustainable change that have people feeling respected, valued, and prioritized. One way to get out of this mess is to participate in one of our online workshops called How to Divide Household and Family-Related Tasks Without Hating Each Other. It comes with pre-built and customizable systems to help you get clarity on who does what, how it's done,
how often, etc. You'll leave the workshop with research-based strategies on running a household and family that sets relationships up for success. And you'll likely have a few light bulbs go off about why what you've been doing hasn't been working. This workshop includes the exact system that I've been teaching clients for years, plus customizable household and family-related task templates and a weekly meeting outline that you can tweak to fit your specific needs. There's a framework for how to figure out what's fair, which is weirdly difficult, especially when there's a stay-at-home parent, tools to get and stay on the same page. But if even suggesting participating in something like this with your partner elicits a wild amount of defensiveness, or just the thought of bringing it up feels like daunting, like this is going to totally start a fight, I'd start with Well Mama, our online course and community for moms who are tired of saying, why do I have to tell you what to do? Why can't you just know? Who definitely used to be more fun, but can't quite remember what used to light them up. Both of these resources can be found at www.micahross.com/workshops. Also, do not forget to check out Caitlin Collins' book, Making Motherhood Work. Links for all of these resources will be in the show notes below. P.S. Leaving a review and or a rating for the podcast helps us more than you know. And I actually do a real live happy dance when we receive one. You deserve happy relationships. Let us know how we can help you talk about it.